two words the natural gas industry is learning the hard way.
Supply and demand.
From APM, American Public Media, I'm Jeremy Hobson in Los Angeles.
And I'm David Brancaccio in New York. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Thursday, April the 12th.
Coming up, why quitting your job can be a good sign for the economy.
And the business side of music in New Orleans.
Plus, analyzing the great time suck.
Just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Anyone who's filled up a gas tank recently would probably conclude there's not enough supply and there's too much demand. That's why it costs about $4 a gallon on average nationwide to fill the tank. But when it comes to natural gas, the supply-demand problem, just the opposite.
Yeah, that's right. Producers have been fracking like crazy. That's an industry term. And natural gas prices are now at their lowest level since 2002. Julie Neiman is an energy analyst with Smith Moore & Company. She's with us now from St. Louis. Good morning.
Morning, Jeremy.
Well, tell us why natural gas prices are falling so much. I thought that global energy demand was going up.
Well, the beauty about natural gas is demand is certainly up, but the pricing is way down simply because of supply. We dropped below $2 per 1,000 cubic feet for the first time yesterday in 10 years, which is absolutely huge. The demand right now is really going more toward chemical companies, aluminum and steel companies, fertilizer companies, and heating your home. Now, the kicker here is natural gas supplies are 60% higher than normal after the last 5 years. This is a huge amount that they've got now in storage, and there's simply not much more room to put more into storage, but they're still continuing to produce.
But we have demand for energy in general, right? So is it just that we don't have the technology to get the natural gas into whatever we want to use to consume energy?
Well, natural gas has mostly industrial uses and heating uses. What we don't use it for is driving.
Right.
Does it make sense to use it? Yes, it's very clean burning, very low emissions. It would certainly help with pollution, but it's quite expensive to convert a car over to compressed natural gas.
Julie Neiman is an oil and gas analyst at Smith Moore & Company in St. Louis. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
A new worrying hint this morning about America's job market. The number of people signing up for unemployment benefits rose by 13,000 over the last week. That puts the seasonally adjusted number at 380,000. The consensus of economists was for the number to fall. So, a surprise, and not a good one. Heidi Shierholz is a labor economist at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington. Ms. Shierholz, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So these new unemployment claims for the past week, what do you make of this?
Okay, you never want to see these things go up. That is, you want to see them going in the right direction, heading down. But I'm not too worried about what happened this time around. That increase of 13,000, it's not a huge spike, and there is a ton of week-to-week variation in these numbers. So we haven't seen a lot of improvement in the last couple of months, but the overall trend, if you eyeball this thing going back the last couple of years, is a pretty steady improvement. So we want to keep our eyes on it. We don't want this thing to go up, but I'm not too worried about what we saw in the numbers this morning.
We also learned this week, Heidi, that more Americans are quitting their jobs on their own volition because they want to. What does that tell you?
Yeah, it's sort of counterintuitive, right? But that's actually very good news for the labor market. In a really dynamic labor market where there's lots of job opportunities, that means there's not just job opportunities for unemployed people. There's also job opportunities for people with jobs. One of the ways people in this labor market see advancement, see wage increases, is through quitting the job they have and moving to one that's a better match for them, a better fit for their skills, their experience, with better wages. So the fact that we're seeing people voluntarily leave their jobs and presumably in many cases taking another job, that actually is a very good sign of healing in the labor market.
Because it takes a sense that things are going in the right direction for you to have the nerve to make the jump.
Yeah, Exactly. I think that one of the problems that we've seen in the labor market over the last few years is that hiring is very low. The job opportunities just aren't out there for either the unemployed or for people with jobs who want to move up and on. So the fact that we're seeing people feel the confidence to voluntarily leave their job is a good signal that's starting to head in the right direction. One thing we do have to note, however, is that voluntary quits are still very low compared to where they were before the recession started. So there's a lot of room to make up. There's a lot we have to make up before we're at a truly healthy labor market. But this is, it's good news that it's headed there.
All right. Heidi Shierholz, economist at the Economic Policy Institute. Thank you for this.
Thanks for having me.
Well, for another take on the job picture, let's bring in Diane Swonk, chief economist with Mesirow Financial. She's with us now from Chicago. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Diane, is this weekly jobless claims number more bad news for the job market after last week's disappointing monthly report?
Well, I think we have to keep it in context that we did have an earlier than usual Easter after last year's later than usual Easter, and that does mess up some of these numbers a bit. That probably added about 10,000 to the number. That said, we also had upward revisions to the previous week, and what it tells us is, yes, you know, the world is still not a perfect place. We saw a lot of hiring in the beginning of the year because of unseasonably warm winter weather, and now we're getting some payback to that because many of the people who were hired are already hired.
All right. Well, let me ask you about something else that's job related. There's this controversy now that started, I guess, last night when this Democratic consultant named Hillary Rosen said that Mitt Romney's wife, Ann Romney, had, quote, never worked a day in her life. Ann Romney comes back and responds on Twitter that she chose to stay home and raise five boys. Believe me, it was hard work, she wrote. Now, taking the politics out of it, Diane, if we can, how do economists like you factor in the work that's done by stay-at-home moms?
Well, this has been an issue that's been going on since the 1970s when baby boomers en masse started to enter the labor force. Women in particular started to enter the labor force en masse and work instead of stay at home. And what we really see is that, you know, it's very hard to calculate it directly in the numbers, and there have been many estimates of what their contribution is, and clearly they are making a contribution at the very high end of the income spectrum and at the very low end of the income spectrum where you can't afford daycare. What they're doing is making it more productive for the higher income earner, who happens to be a man in this case, be able to work and do their job. So there's no question that it's showing up implicitly in the overall GDP of the U.S. economy, but it's not getting, of course, maybe the deserved credit it gets for the role that women play across the economy, and this is an ongoing effort, an ongoing issue for both sides of the aisle.
Diane Swonk, chief economist with Mesirow Financial, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
The new boss of battered electronics giant Sony says he sees the company's future in three things: digital imaging, video games, and mobile electronics. Notice he did not say TV sets or laptop computers. Kazuo Hirai also confirmed reports that Sony will cut 10,000 jobs this year, but he's quoted as saying that he will definitely change Sony and revive it.
We'll get a look at how the tech sector is doing today. Google is going to report its quarterly earnings after the stock market closes. Now, the company has been doing a lot of spending lately on new businesses and technology, but how much money is coming in from Google's bread-and-butter business, those ads it sells next to search results? Marketplace's Quina Kim reports.
When it comes to tech these days, it's all about mobile. It's becoming the way we search online. Benjamin Schachter is an internet analyst for Macquarie Research.
We think that right now you're probably talking at somewhere between 12 and 15% of all searches happening on mobile devices. And by the end of just 2012, you're likely to see that number move to 25 to 30%.
For Google, the trend is a mixed blessing. The company's mobile business is growing, but mobile ads are bringing in less per click than search ads on a computer. Google says its revenue per click was down 8% last quarter. Colin Gillis is a tech analyst for BGC Financial. He says there are just some things that people don't want to buy on a cell phone.
Not many people are looking to buy a car or purchase an airline ticket necessarily from their smartphone.
Google also gives a cut of its sales to companies like Apple in return for being a search engine on iPhones and iPads. Analysts say Google could boost its mobile ad revenue if the company's investments in social media and mobile pan out. I'm Quina Kim for Marketplace.
New Orleans is getting ready for its annual Jazz Fest, which starts at the end of the month. And while I'm sure the music will be fantastic as usual, it turns out the Crescent City music industry has a little work to do when it comes to the business side of things. Zoe Sullivan has more now from New Orleans.
New Orleans is practically synonymous with music. There's Jazz Fest, Louis Armstrong, and Lil Wayne.
Where everything happening today, you don't know whether you're coming or going. But
still, just because music is a big business here doesn't mean that the artists are the ones making the money. Wild Wayne is a local DJ.
A lot of artists that have, you know, made some top 10 records across the country, you know, if you look back through the annals of New Orleans music history, you know, didn't get paid, you know? You had somebody that made off like a fat rat, but it wasn't the artist.
Wayne wants artists to get a bigger cut, so he and a business partner started a monthly event called Industry Influence. It's the first Monday of the month in a desolate industrial neighborhood. Hundreds of young African-American men and some women line up for the latest Industry Influence night.
It's definitely where we come together and meet, talk about politics of music in the city, arts.
This is Dapa. He's a rapper with a local group called the Rap Pack.
This is where we come together, and this is here where we did our first show.
It's like culinary arts in the kitchen. Cook it, cut it, and ship it.
He's here to learn how to deal with copyright issues, but he's also here to make contacts and show his group's stuff. Industry Influence has met regularly for 5 years. Hundreds of artists come each month to network and learn from panels on topics like monetizing your music. They also come to perform. Wild Wayne says the business skills are a big reason for the program's success.
What we do for the cats that are talented but don't have the business, I just think we make them whole. And when you make someone whole and they can make their own money, it just kind of goes back to the teach a man the fish concept.
While Dwayne and his partner are talking about expanding Industry Influence to other markets, like Jackson, Mississippi, and Eastern Texas. In New Orleans, I'm Zoe Sullivan for Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
Today, let's quantify what's affectionately known as the time suck. How much time we devote to technology is the subject of our weekly attitude check.
And the latest poll numbers suggest margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the polling firm Gallup. He joins us every Thursday. Good morning, Frank.
Good morning, David.
So I've done a survey of one, me, and I'm using technology 4 hours a day outside of work. Is that bizarre, typical?
Well, what we know is that a lot of younger Americans are really worried about spending too much time using screens. That's what we call them. That would be using their phones, smartphones, or using the internet. In fact, we were really surprised at this. Startling results. Almost 6 in 10 18 to 29-year-olds told us that they feel guilty. They spend too much time using their cell phone or their smartphone, and they spend too much time using the internet. And almost half say they spend too much time on social media sites such as Facebook.
The question then becomes when the guilt matures into doing something about it.
Well, that's absolutely the question. I was wondering, are we going to have a backlash? Will we have young Americans saying too much? I'm going to stop, you know, we're going to have screen-free days and Silicon Valley is going to collapse. You know, in our research, we have asked people who smoke, do you smoke too much? Oh, absolutely. I shouldn't be smoking at all. I should quit. We ask overweight people, how do you feel? Oh, I should be losing weight. So a lot of people know they're doing something that's wrong, but whether or not they're able to change this is the real question. So we don't know if young people ultimately are going to stop looking at those screens so much. We just know that right now they think they're spending too much time doing it.
Is there a split between genders here?
There really wasn't much difference between men and women. There was a difference by education, which was interesting. In general, people aren't as concerned about doing too much email. However, email is related to education. If you have a college degree or a postgraduate degree, that's where you get higher and higher and turn worry about you're spending too much time on email. So education is a variable in there. But men and women look like they're about the same in terms of worry about spending too much time staring at those screens.
So much guilt. Call it the guilted age. Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the polling firm Gallup. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Also, to keep this thread going, if Norman Rockwell were here, he'd paint the modern American family dining out, parents chewing, kids' face buried in a Game Boy. Now Chili's is making it official. The restaurant chain is installing touch screens on tables so Junior can disappear into more games and so parents can order more drinks, get dessert, or pay the bill without having to flag down a human. Hey, if a touchscreen is good enough to buy unleaded gasoline, why not a Chili's Presidente margarita?
Sounds good, David, but let me go from margaritas to mint chip. That's what the Canadians are calling their new idea for a digital form of currency. They've phased out the penny, or they're phasing out the penny. Now they want to bring it back in digital form and call it the mint chip. Scott Peterson covers business for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. He joins us now from Toronto. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
Well, you know, when I hear mint chip, I think it's like my favorite kind of ice cream. But tell us what it is in this case.
Yeah, it's not a rocky road. It's like a debit card, basically. What we're doing here is the Canadian Mint, which is the government, basically, out of Ottawa, wants to come up with this so-called mint chip, which is it's a prototype at this point. It's almost intended like a debit card or an app in your computer or even something you can download like a USB stick, basically to pay for what they're calling microtransactions, and that's anything under $10. And so basically you can, have this instead of cash, basically.
But how does it work? Because it's not tied to your bank account. So I guess technically then you wouldn't have to have the money in order to spend it, right?
Yeah, that's part of the appeal here is that there's no personal information attached because a lot of people, if you're surfing the web and buying something off the web, you're afraid of downloading that personal information. So that's why they're calling for applications right now for developers. And it's basically we're going to find out at the end of the summer who's won this contest and it's basically how to define this thing. How does it work? Whether it's going to be a chip that we carry around on a card, whether it's something we can swipe. Starbucks has it already, for example. You can swipe your phone up against the computer. So at this point, we're waiting for these app developers. There's a $50,000 prize attached to this. So it's a bit of a question mark exactly how this thing will work.
Well, are there concerns, though, already about not having a physical currency?
Yeah, there's a lot of people are asking the same thing. Like, what happens if you load up your card with a lot of money and you lose it? I mean, so there is some question marks. And we're expecting that to be fleshed out from these app developers as far as, having some sort of security or the ability to cancel it. But at this point, you're right. It's a double-edged sword. In one instance, you have no personal information attached to it. And in the other is how to make that a little bit more secure.
Scott Peterson with the CBC joining us from Toronto. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Leaders in Washington, D.C. are talking about changing the current height regulations on buildings in that city. Now, that city's famous for having no skyscrapers and a strict building height limit. But would changing the height restrictions maybe change the economy of Washington?
Here to talk with us in today's Midday Extra is Shalom Baranis, a D.C.-based architect. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, I lived in D.C. for a long time, and it seemed like nobody ever really knew what the exact rules were. Can you enlighten us about what the restrictions are right now?
Sure. Generally, the height limitation of buildings is based on the width of the streets. It has nothing to do with the idea that buildings need to be lower than the civic buildings, such as the U.S. Capitol or any of the memorials or anything like that. So, for example, downtown, where we have most of the commercial buildings, you can build buildings that are typically 20 feet wider than the right-of-way of the street. Hmm. So, most streets are anywhere from 90 to 110 feet wide. So that would mean that you could build commercial buildings from 110 to 130 feet wide. And the one exception to that is Pennsylvania Avenue, where you can go a little bit taller than that.
Why were those planning decisions made? It was just a taste consideration?
No, they were originally related back at the turn of the 19th century to concerns about safety. An apartment building called the Cairo was built just north of DuPont Circle here, and it was much, much taller than anything around it. And people became concerned about safety issues, about buildings getting much taller than that building. And so an act was passed to limit buildings' heights to the formula that I just described.
So do you think that it's possible that people could actually change these rules and allow taller buildings to be built?
Well, it certainly is possible, but the unusual thing about Washington, of course, as compared to any other American city, is that Congress would have to be involved with that. And what happens, of course, is once this kind of change, this kind of proposal gets thrown into the congressional context, there's no telling what will happen. This topic catches a lot of fire about every 10, 15 years. Mm. And this time, however, I have to say there seems to be a little bit more interest from certain people in Congress. So maybe this time the discussion will get a little bit further than it has in the past.
Now, in the unlikely event that Congress were to agree on anything, perhaps even these height restrictions for D.C., how might it change Washington? Certainly, obviously, in a visual sense, you'd see taller, bigger buildings. But do you think it would actually change the fabric of the city in some way?
No, I don't think so. Not at all. I mean, there are two different ideas being discussed. And these ideas have been out there in the public for a long time. I mean, the city would continue to have a very horizontal quality. Buildings would still be fairly low. And all it would mean is that buildings in other parts of the city would be able to become almost as tall as the buildings on Pennsylvania Avenue, but not quite as tall. So that would not result in a major visual change to the city. When you stand in the middle of the city now, whether you're downtown or in Georgetown, and you look across the Potomac River, you see a lot of these skyscrapers in Roslyn in Virginia. And what would happen is that you would have that same panoramic view that you currently have from Georgetown across the river, you would have that same view across perhaps the city and Anacostia River, which is on the other side of town. You would look across the Capitol, across the mall, and in the far distance, you would see a few skyscrapers.
Shalom, let me ask you one more thing. Because this is Marketplace, I want to ask you an economic question here, which is D.C. has famously over the last several years had this booming real estate market and prices that keep going up. Do you think that if buildings were allowed to be taller, that would change, that prices would go down for D.C. real estate?
No, not at all. I mean, what happens is that the price of land is driven by the allowable density on any one of these sites. And no one builds buildings because they're allowed to build them. You know, people build buildings because there's a demand. And to the extent that there's a demand, you know, we'll keep building. And right now, there's enough construction going on to address the demand, to fulfill the demand. It's a market-driven economy as anywhere else. So all this means, if the heights are raised, is that rather than some of this demand being met in certain neighborhoods downtown, they'll be met in other neighborhoods where the height restrictions are taller. But it would not result in any additional new construction.
Shalom Baranis is a Washington-based architect. Mr. Baranis, thank you very much.
You're quite welcome.
And finally to South Greensburg, Pennsylvania, where one local official has had it with garage sales. He is proposing a new law that would limit residents to 2 two-day sales per year. That's it. He told KDKA-TV he wants a law so that he can, quote, prevent people from going to flea markets, buying junk, bringing it home, then putting it into their garage and calling it a garage sale. Sounds like a good idea to me. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm David Brancaccio in New York. And this is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.